dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. I'll be escorting you about a special edition of the War for the Free World's tour here on Pearl Harbor Day, a day we must reflect upon what has happened in the past and what may now be in the offing. I'll be discussing that with you momentarily. In segment two, we'll be speaking with Claire Lopez, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, about the headlines now being made daily by the Islamic Republic of Iran. What is going on there, and what does it mean for you? That's segment two. Segment three, we'll be visiting with a very important and senior official in the Drug Enforcement Agency, Supervisory Special Agent Jeffrey Scott, about what is happening under America's borders, tunneling now being done with a very high level of sophistication by people bringing drugs and who knows what all else into this country. What's going on there? What's being done about it? We'll talk with Jeffrey Scott about that in segment three. In segment four, we visit with our boots on the ground man, Jim Hansen. We'll get his take on what is happening in Pakistan at the moment. Not much of it good, that's for sure. We'll be also visiting with him about the implications of the defense budget cuts and apparently a decision by Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta to fall into line behind the president in supporting what he had previously described as catastrophic cuts to our national security capabilities. All of that and more straight ahead. But first, some thoughts about Pearl Harbor Day. It was, of course, 70 years ago now that the United States found itself propelled suddenly into the most horrific global cataclysm in the history of the world. It was a time of great uncertainty, made all the more so by the surprise attack that killed 2,400 or so of our people at Pearl Harbor. It took us by surprise. It forced us to shake off the folly that had afflicted so many Americans, believing that if we simply tended to our own knitting here at home, everybody else would leave us alone. We now know, at least we should know, that that's not so, that far from being seen as innocent and undeserving of others' aggression, our passivity, our lack of resolve, our seeming weakness, or at the time of Pearl Harbor, our actual weakness, is provocative and brought us to the brink of catastrophe. Fortunately, having mobilized the immense resources and manpower and capabilities of this great nation, 4 years after Pearl Harbor, we were successful in achieving the unconditional surrender of those who had brought us that attack and their Nazi and fascist allies. 10 years ago, we were attacked again, this time with aircraft hijacked from commercial passenger service to be flown with deadly effect into buildings in New York and Washington, D.C. Once again, many Americans were taken by complete surprise, unaware that the threat that materialized on that occasion existed, let alone that it was vectored towards us. We are, a decade later, still engaged in what I think of as the war for the free world. And unfortunately, unconditional surrender on the part of our enemies is nowhere in sight. In fact, it's not even being sought by our government. to the contrary, I suspect that our enemies believe what we are about with our withdrawal completely from Iraq at the end of this year, and with our incipient withdrawal from Afghanistan and the negotiations we seek with the Taliban to effect our surrender to our enemies. Again, I fear that the effect will be simply seen by them as provocative, an invitation to further aggression against us. Worse yet, there are now vastly more devastating surprise attacks, seemingly in the works. For example, we know that North Korea and Iran and Russia and China and perhaps others are very aware of the United States' vulnerability to what is known as electromagnetic pulse attack, or EMP strikes, that would involve, most efficiently, launching a nuclear weapon into space over this country, detonating it outside of the atmosphere and creating this immense electromagnetic pulse that would damage, if not catastrophically, cause the failure of our electrical grid and, in rapid succession, all of the infrastructures that require electricity to operate. Those infrastructures, of course, include what we rely upon to provide us water, sewage, food, medicine, telecommunications, finance, transportation, and on and on. In other words, we would have a country that depends critically upon such infrastructures transformed in quite literally the blink of an eye into a nation which no longer has any of them and may not for years to come. Because if, among other things, the transformers that are the backbone of that electrical grid are damaged or destroyed, it will be exceedingly difficult, exceedingly costly, and exceedingly time-consuming before they can be replaced, and the grid, to say nothing of the other infrastructures, brought back online. The same can be achieved, perhaps, through non-violent means, that is to say, through cyber attacks. We have seen enemies of this country experimenting with such attacks, including some, it seems, aimed at our infrastructure. Certainly, they could do incalculable harm to the electrical grid by attacking the computers that operate it. And the cascading effect, again, that would flow from that is almost unimaginably damaging to our society, to our form of government, to our way of life. Another possible means of doing this sort of devastating harm to us would be were an enemy to unleash biological agents against this country, viruses that could be simply devastating to a population that is not shielded against them. Genetic engineering of such viruses can make them infinitely more toxic. These are scenarios that have been examined in a chilling way by Colonel Drew Miller, United States Air Force retired, in a book called Rohan Nation, Reinventing America After the 2020 Collapse. I've just finished reading it. I commend it to all of you. It is the sort of thing that all of us should think hard about, lest we perpetuate the vulnerabilities that Colonel Miller so vividly describes, that not only would make surprise attacks on our electrical grid of one kind or another, or against our population using biological warfare, so catastrophic, but that may invite such attacks, much as our lack of awareness, our lack of resolve, our lack of preparedness did, arguably, Pearl Harbor and the attacks of 9/11. We simply cannot afford to allow any more of these attacks, and we must be doing everything we can now to prepare to prevent them. Those are my thoughts. I'd welcome yours. SecureFreedomRadio.com is one way to get in touch with us. Frank Gaffney, Twitter or Facebook accounts or another. Next up, Claire Lopez on what the devil's going on in Iran. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
We could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're going to turn now to a conversation about a country that is much in the nation's headlines at the moment, and properly so. It is a festering sore on the Middle East, a nation that is increasingly, I believe, a threat both to our interests, our friends, and perhaps to us as well. It's the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here to discuss it with me is my much-admired colleague, woman who spent a good part of her career in the CIA as a case officer, and a woman who has contributed enormously to my understanding of so many matters, Claire Lopez. Welcome back. You have spent much of your career focusing on Iran, of course, and I wanted to visit with you about it because it's much in the news at the moment. Let's start with some of the things that have been happening inside Iran of late. We've had nuclear scientists killed. We've had a missile base apparently flattened in a huge explosion. And more recently, a seeming another accidental development, we're told, at nuclear weapons research facility, suspected research facility. These seem like a lot of bad things happening in Iran. Is there any possibility in your professional judgment that these are all accidents?
Oh, thank you, Frank. It's great to be back with you. just as you mentioned, the sequence of events, they go back now many months, and there are more of them than just the ones even that you've mentioned, including attacks on the IRGC, attacks on IRGC, that's
the
Islamic
Revolutionary
Guard Corps, planes falling out of the sky, and so forth. That sequence taken together really would seem to indicate that this is more than accidents. That this is more than simply mistakes, accidents inside of these facilities. It seems to be a campaign. Now, whether that is an internal campaign to Iran, meaning that there are elements inside of Iran working to bring down the regime, or at least to harm set back Iran's nuclear weapons program, and or are there outside elements helping them? That is another question.
Yeah, we, I guess, don't know the answer. But talk to us about this blast at the Shahab 3 missile facility. I've had people describe, having talked with friends who are still living inside Iran, some 30 kilometers away from this episode, that their houses were shaken powerfully by the blast, 30 kilometers away. What, again, in your estimation, might have caused such a blast, and what did it do to the facility itself?
Well, the facility you're talking about was a ballistic missile research and development facility, and it was a quite extensive a facility. And if you look at overhead satellite photos that are on the web now, they're on the internet, and you can see the before and the after shots next to each other. This was a significant facility with numerous buildings, and you look at the after photograph, and these buildings are flattened. They're sticks. At least three or four buildings are completely destroyed, and others are visibly damaged in the satellite photographs you can see. So this was a very significant blast. As you say, it was felt and heard many kilometers away by Iranians. And it apparently was a very significant facility that had to do with the delivery system, the Shahab-3 missile that Iran intends for its delivery vehicle for its weapons of mass destruction, be they chemical, biological, or nuclear in particular. But the Iranian regime completely shut down all kinds of communication about that site or anything that happened to it right afterwards. It's very difficult to tell what happened or who may have done it, but the sequence of all these different attacks really points to some sort of a campaign. There's no other way to look at it.
Yeah. Claire Lopez is our guest, again, a woman who spent a long and impressive career in the service of her country at the CIA. She is currently working with us at the Center for Security Policy and helping the country continue to train its personnel to do the sorts of important clandestine work that she was involved in during her time in government. Claire, speaking of which, there seems to be growing evidence that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, of which you spoke earlier, is being mobilized. It's Al-Quds sort of elite units, we're told, being put on a war footing. Do you credit those reports? And if so, what do you think they're likely to be used for?
I think this is a regime that knows it is in trouble. This is a regime that is opposed by the vast majority of its own people. Ever since, of course, the Iranian elections, presidential elections of 2009, it is very clear to the entire world that the people do not support this regime at all. Now we're hearing, that there are attacks going on against nuclear facilities inside of Iran, including Isfahan, the nuclear conversion facility, as well as the missile facility we talked about. This regime has got to be fearful of what is going on. It knows that it is being targeted both internally and externally. And add to that, in addition, very likely internal feuds. We know that the Supreme Leader, for instance, Khamenei, has spoken about abolishing the presidency. The feud between him, Khamenei, and the current president, Ahmadinejad, whose term runs out next year, or I should say at the end of next year. So beset from within, beset from without, this is a regime that is in trouble, and it knows it. So putting its elite IRGC forces, perhaps Quds forces, on alert, as we've seen in news reports, sounds like they are giving, letting the world know, we're ready, you know, come at us. But what it really gives away is their own insecurity.
Mm. Do you anticipate, Claire Lopez, that they may be used preemptively to attack either Israel, American interests, Strait of Hormuz, or other of the targets that have been bruited about? Is this something that we should be anticipating as a distinct possibility?
Well, I think it's certainly a possibility. The warnings that have come out of the Quds Force leadership, Soleimani, Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC, Jafari, have been very aggressive over recent days, as well as from other leaders, for instance, the parliamentary speaker, Ali Larijani, very aggressive. It may not be that they would be used in a preemptive strike. The nuclear weapon, if and when it is ready for delivery, possibly, I think, could be used as a preemptive attack. But at the moment, it seems to me that what they're doing is showing themselves ready on the defensive, because they think that Israel or other parties, and perhaps in coordination with internal opposition pro-democracy forces inside the country, going to attack them. Mm-hmm. So I think what they're doing is putting them all on notice that they're ready for them. Not necessarily that they would use those as a preemptive attack, but the nuclear weapon, and in particular, that nuclear weapon could be used, we haven't mentioned this, but as an EMP attack. I know you've spoken about this before, but an electromagnetic pulse weapon, yeah. A single one of which explosion could take out the electronic systems, everything computer-based in any country or region that is exploded over.
Mm. And they certainly have been preparing, it appears, for that
kind
of
attack. We know that they have tested and tried.
Claire, we've got about a minute and a half left. Quickly, there are reports as well that another element of the Iranian offensive capability, namely its proxies, Hezbollah, which now run Lebanon, may be spoiling for a fight with Israel. What's your reading on that? Do you anticipate that that may be where we see things blow up first?
I think you're on to something exactly, Frank. I think Lebanon is a tinderbox at this point in time. Hezbollah, of course, is the primary terror proxy that Iran has used over the years. And it is the primary threat to Israel across its northern border, as you say, from Lebanon, which Hezbollah controls. But it is part, I think we have to understand Hezbollah as part of the Iranian force structure. Mm-hmm. And by having Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, also making bellicose, aggressive statements publicly, that is also part of the Iranian regime's putting the world on notice. You touch us, and we have capabilities to strike back. And may it be noted that Hezbollah not only can strike Israel, but has forces all over the world, including in North, Central, and South America.
Yeah. Ominous stuff indeed. Claire Lopez, we're glad you're on the case, as always. Your expertise on Iran and many other things is deeply valued by us. Keep up the good work. Come back to us again soon.
Thank you.
Next up, we talked to a senior Drug Enforcement Agency official about a new threat developing under our borders. You're not going to want to miss this. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Supervisory Special Agent Jeffrey Scott. He currently heads the Drug Enforcement Agency's Office of Congressional and Public Affairs, but he is in that capacity, having served for 16 years in the Drug Enforcement Agency and seen a lot of stuff going on, both in this country and elsewhere, related to the importation through illegal means of dangerous drugs, and I imagine other hazardous materials as well. Special Agent Jeffrey Scott, thank you so much for joining us. There's been some interesting stuff going on in particularly the southwest sector of the borders of the United States, San Diego, deep underground. Tell us what you've been finding lately and what you make of the people who are doing this and what kind of capabilities may yet to be discovered.
Well, recently, November 30th, actually, our San Diego Tunnel Task Force discovered an extensive, actually, from what my understanding is and talking to the guys out there, it's one of the most, if not the most elaborate smuggling tunnel that they've uncovered in the Otay Mesa area. Our San Diego Tunnel Task Force has been working out there since about mid-2003. And it was created specifically to address the investigative challenge presented by these tunnels that we're seeing. In the last 4 years, we've detected about 75 cross-border smuggling tunnels, most of them in California and Arizona. And the one discovered last week, or the 30th, is about the seventh large-scale drug smuggling tunnel discovered in the San Diego area since 2006.
And give us a sense, when you say they're sophisticated, they're large scale, what, as a practical matter, does that mean, both in terms of the kinds of costs, the investment that's going into these things, and technology, for that matter?
Well, I mean, actually, we, from an investigative standpoint, identify really three types of tunnels. One are the rudimentary ones, which are really no more than gopher holes. And the second are interconnecting type of tunnels, which typically use construction that's already there, say sewer pipes or drainage systems. And when I was in Arizona, we saw a lot of that on the border in and around Nogales, for instance. And then we also see the third type, which are the sophisticated sort of tunnels, which this one in Otay Mesa would be. And in this tunnel, for instance, the entrance on the Mexican side was accessed through a hydraulically controlled steel door and an elevator, which was concealed beneath the warehouse floor. Typically, a sophisticated tunnel like that, or a super tunnel, is going to have power, water, elevators, rail systems, entire ventilation system to support the thousands of pounds of marijuana that are moved through them.
Do you have a sense, Special Agent Jeffrey Scott, of how widespread the application of this kind of technology is? When you roll up a tunnel, and I gather this one was relatively recently completed, do you think that represents a real setback, or is it kind of the tip of the iceberg and there's probably an awful lot more of this going on than we're aware of at the moment? Is there any way to say?
Well, I think that a tunnel of this magnitude and this sophistication is a setback. I mean, obviously, these present investigative challenges because, the cartels have really, no budget constraints, and they can use expert engineers and cartographers to help prepare these things, create these things. But it takes quite a bit of skill to do it. It takes quite a bit of time to do it, and it takes quite a bit of money to do it. So when we grab a sophisticated tunnel like this, I think it is a setback. And this had been a six-month investigation capped off really by the seizure of the tunnel. And, between the tunnel itself, the seizures that occurred on either side of the border as a direct result of finding it, we had about 32 tons of marijuana that were seized. That's a significant amount at any time. And, this particular tunnel was 612 yards long, to give you an idea of the scope of what we were dealing with. And this one did have electric rail cars to help move the marijuana, under it, through it. It had lighting and it had reinforced walls and wooden doors. That's going to be difficult to replace for any cartel.
We're speaking once again with Supervisory Special Agent Jeffrey Scott. He currently is assigned to the DEA Office of Congressional and Public Affairs here in Washington, D.C., but has served in the field, including in the Los Angeles Field Division, for some 16 years. We appreciate your service very much, Special Agent Scott. Let me ask you this. To what extent can we calculate how much of an investment this sort of elaborate super tunnel, as you call it, would represent? And is it, again, simply an example of the incredible sums that are at work in this drug trafficking? And does it in turn mean that perhaps there's corruption that is enabling these tunnels to be built surreptitiously in what you would think otherwise would be a tough thing to accomplish?
Well, there's a lot kind of wound up into that question. I mean, we took 32 tons of marijuana out of this tunnel complex. That has a street value, anywhere from $50 to $65 million. So that amount of profit indicates that really the scale of the investment in this tunnel is kind of minimal. I mean, even if it took $5 million to make this tunnel, for instance, and I'm just pulling a number out, clearly the return on that investment is substantial. So
to say nothing of what it might be able to generate over time if you hadn't intercepted.
Right, sure. I mean, that was one load over one period of time. If that tunnel had been operating or could have operated for another year or 2 years, then any amount of money that it took to create it would have been made back, tenfold or a hundredfold. The thing in terms of how to create these and corruption. You know, the Otay Mesa, which where this one was found, it's particularly vulnerable to tunneling activity, really for two reasons. One is simply geography. There's some kind of favorable soil composition that makes digging easier, unfortunately. And secondly, there's a tremendous amount of infrastructure and local commerce on both sides of the border right there. So you have warehouses and things like that, which make it somewhat easier to conceal the sort of digging and the sort of logistical work that you're going to have to do to make a tunnel. So you don't need corruption to do that. You just need space and the willpower and the initiative. And Otay Mesa in particular, you know, unfortunately provides that. Said we found several tunnels in the last few years, and several of them have been located in that particular area. It's a high commerce area, so it lends itself to it.
Yeah, again, Special Agent Scott, let me just drill down, if I may, literally. Where would the dirt go, for example? Would that have been removed on the Mexican side, and would that be something, without getting into your operations, sources, and methods, that you would look for as a telltale that something like this is underway?
Yeah, I mean, our tunnel task force out there in San Diego, and we have similar task forces kind of in other parts of the border there, including Arizona, you know, have kind of developed some, you know, means and methods for IDing this sort of activity. It's not easy sometimes, but, you know, we've got some guys out there who are particularly good at it. You know, just to give you an example, you know, there's a lot of dirt that's got to come out of an excavation like that, but if you have purchased or erected a large warehouse and you have nothing in that warehouse other than the tunnel that you're moving dope through, then it's not hard to hide that dirt right there in the warehouse itself. Just simply pull it out and stack it in the corner. So, and also you can move it under the cover of night, the dirt itself out, you know, in covered trucks and things like that. That's why these high commerce areas that kind of populate the border, where you have warehouses and lots of kind of strip mall type, you know, areas and trade areas right on the border that huddle there together, represent some challenges, because it is easy to hide and move large quantities of about anything, dirt, marijuana, or whatnot, in commercial vehicles and commercial trucks. So, you know, these tunnels do represent some investigative challenges, but again, you know, if you know what to look for, and you know, we've obviously got some technology working on our side to help with that, and we've got some guys who've spent a lot of time kind of IDing these sorts of locations. You know, we've been very effective, given how effective these smuggling methods are. We've done an equally good job of locating them.
Well, we're counting on you to keep it up. Supervisory Special Agent Jeffrey Scott has been our guest. Thank you again for the work you're doing and those of your colleagues trying to keep our borders secure from drugs and other things that could be coming through those tunnels. And we'll look forward to catching up with you as you continue this important work in the future. Thank you so much for joining us. Next up, Jim Henson.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful, all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we are each week by Jim Hansen, a special operator in the United States Army, now retired, off doing business, as they say, and every once in a while we get him on to do a little business with us here at Secure Freedom Radio, specifically bringing what I like to think of as the boots on the ground perspective to our labors. Jim, we've been following with considerable concern what's been happening in Pakistan at the moment as it bears on our ability to use transit routes through there and bases for drones and the support of the Pakistani military on the border. To the extent any of those things are of real value, in their absence, what's your sense of how things are likely to play out in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, Frank, I wish they weren't of use. You know, I mean, that's the problem. They are extreme utility. Because we don't have an option. I mean, it's a landlocked country, Afghanistan. And so to fight a war there, you know, we have either to use massive amounts of air power, which was really unsustainable, almost a Berlin airlift mentality to supply ourselves, or we need to bring it in over the ground, you know, from the north or the east. And Pakistan, being our supposed better ally, we've been using their country. We've been transiting their country. And it's been a debacle. You know, it's been horrendous. We've needed it. We've made a lot of, we've caved to their, you know, requests for pretty much almost a Danegeld mentality for paying to cross their country. And now, you know, given the events on the border, you know, the unfortunate incident, which, may have been provoked, may have been Al-Qaeda or Taliban related. But now we're in a situation where we're evacuating the airbase we use to you know, support a lot of the drone strikes. We're getting a lot of flack about the overland convoy routes. And I guess, you know, I hate to say, maybe it's a good thing, you know, that the war there is over. You know, or, you know, we don't need it anymore. I don't know. It's a debacle at this point, and I don't see any way it's going to get any better.
Jim, just to drill down on that for a moment, the border troops that were taken out by our attack helicopters and perhaps fixed-wing aircraft as well were there, we're told, to try to render support to the border, make it a little less easily penetrated by the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and others. The Pakistanis are now saying they're pulling those forces back. We're still, I guess, in the throes of trying to sort out what happened on the occasion. But specifically, how important have been those forces on the border, or more or less on the border of Pakistan, and the joint Pakistani-Afghan-U.S. cells that have been created to try to minimize this kind of fratricidal fire?
You know, Frank, they're necessary. In order for us to operate in those areas, we need local knowledge. You know, I mean, it's the most inhospitable terrain on the planet, and there's no way we can operate, you know, if we're trying to provide, you know, the overwatch, the kind of things that are necessary, the basically the homeboy knowledge. So we got to have somebody there doing that for us, someone who speaks the language, someone who's from around there, someone who's operated there. So the Pakistanis, to some extent, have been providing that assistance, and it has been that we've had tremendous success. You know, I mean, the Bin Laden raid is not the only time we have killed bad guys in Pakistan. We've done quite a few hot pursuits. We've done some high-value target takeouts. You know, there's been a lot of activity there, and we have stacked a lot of dead tangos, you know, stacked them like cordwood. And the bottom line
tangos
is...
Tangos being terrorists.
Yeah, terrorists. And the bottom line is that is in jeopardy, and that what that was facilitated in a lot of ways by intelligence from the Pakistanis and by support from their military. Absent that, we're pretty much flying blind, you know, and we can't do that. You know, so they are necessary if we're going to interdict, make it more difficult for the terrorists to operate, and, you know, to have the opportunity to take them out or capture them when they do find themselves in those areas. So, you know, the idea that we're going to lose that capability is going to greatly hamper our ability to cause damage to the folks who are, you know, attempting to do us damage and do the Afghans damage across the border. So I think all in all, it's going to show a return to the safe havens that has been, you know, the bane of our existence and the bane of that region's problems since the Soviet times.
Yeah. Jim Henson is our guest. Jim blogs at black5.net and has been a driving force behind bigpeace.com, a special operator in the United States Army in his past incarnations. And Jim, drawing on those experiences as well, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Afghanistan at the moment. It certainly seems, based on the horrific attack of yesterday, that the Taliban is able to operate, if not with impunity, certainly with devastating effect. Is this more psychological, would you say, or is it having a real military impact? And are we likely to see it just get that much worse as our forces are drawn down in the days ahead?
I think the psychological is warfare. You know, unfortunately, perception is reality. So, I mean, there's never been a chance that the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or any of these insurgent groups can gain a military victory, but they don't have to. They have to wait out the people they're fighting. They waited out the Soviets, and they, at this point, seem to have waited us out as well. You know, so I guess at this point, I don't think there's much chance of it getting better. I don't see anything we're doing that is going. We never reached a tipping point, never even came close to it. And at this point, we're drawing down, we're moving out, and there is absolutely no possibility that the Afghans are going to fill that void with anything like the capabilities necessary to defeat the enemy. So I think at this point, it's going to be a slide back to, you know, more Taliban control, lots of provinces that have been pacified. And in the end, you know, to the extent that we created anything good there, I think it is going to be taken back.
Hmm. A grim prospect indeed, and therefore I guess you would take with a grain of salt, shall we say, Jim Hansen, Hillary Clinton's assurances at the conference on the future of Afghanistan this week that we're going to be there for them not only through 2014, but for the indefinite future beyond.
Yeah, I think the quote was, we're going to stay the course. If we're staying the course, then the guy driving the boat was also the captain on the Titanic. That was a joke. I mean, a sad one. You know, I hate to make light of a situation that is this unfortunate, but it's comic. You know, I would hate to be the Secretary of State and have to tell lies like that in public with a straight face. She knows we're not doing well. She knows the situation, but she's got to say that. You know, we have to pretend, you know, it's as political as anything else at this point. And Obama's strategy from day one of his campaign, the first time he mentioned Afghanistan in public, he has not made a single decision about our operations in that country or a single statement about our operations in that country that was not more political and strategic in nature. And in the end, you know, this will hang around his neck. You know, he can say all he wants about Iraq, but he is going to hang Afghanistan as a loss around his neck.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right, Jim Hansen. Speaking of politics and the implications for our national security, Jim, we've had the spectacle, I think that's the only way to describe it, of Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, who has properly, to my way of thinking, and I believe yours as well, been warning about the effects of this so-called sequestration mechanism, a doomsday device, he's called it, going forward, now supporting President Obama. Not altogether surprising, I guess. He has to support his boss, but nonetheless supporting his boss in taking exactly that step when he threatens not to allow any repeal of that sequestration mechanism. What do you make of this, and what do you think it's likely to mean for our forces in the field in a minute or so we have left?
You know, Leon Panetta gained a lot of friends. He's a politician by nature, so there was not a lot of support for him among the operational community when he became CIA director or Secretary of Defense. But at the CIA, he gained a reputation for standing up, you know, for the people who actually do the work, and there was hope that that would be the same thing, and there's been some evidence of that during his time as SecDef. He has done some good things. This seems to be a repudiation of all that, you know, and basically, he may have been told, you can leave, you know, you can fall on your sword and call it a day. That doesn't seem to be his style. So I think he may have lost that battle and unfortunately now has to get on board with the Obama plan, and that's let's take money from defense because it's not a dangerous planet anymore.
Yeah, I fear that ain't so, and your analysis may be right on. Jim Hansen, as usual, we'll look forward to seeing how this plays out in the days ahead with you and with our audience, who I will look forward to talking to again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, Jim Hansen, thanks to you and thanks to them. This is Frank Gaffney, over and out.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.